Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Now, the Global Slavery Index estimates that today, some 36 million men, women and children are trapped in slavery all over the world. 36 million. And that incredibly high figure is very jarring, considering that many of us today consider ourselves enlightened and compassionate individuals who wouldn't tolerate slavery at all.
Which is why we're talking today about slavery. It happens to be the International Day for the Abolition of Slavery, today, the 2nd of December. And that focuses on eradicating all forms of modern slavery: people trafficking, sexual exploitation, child labour, forced marriage, bonded labour.
In the second part of the program, we'll be joined by John Dixon, and he's going to talk about slavery in ancient times. But in the first part of the program, we're going to be talking about modern slavery. Our guest is Jenny Stanger, National Manager of the Freedom Partnership, which is an initiative run by the Salvation Army. Welcome to the program, Jenny.
Thank you.
If we could just kick off, are there enslaved people in our midst, you know, even in sunny, modern, liberal Australia?
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the Global Slavery Index's estimate, which is, you know, an estimate of the number of slaves globally. They also have an estimate for Australia, which is that around 3,000 people are currently in slavery in Australia. I mean, in addition to running the Freedom Partnership, the Salvos also operate the country's only safe house for victims of human trafficking and slavery. So in the last 8 years, we've worked with over 300 people trafficked and enslaved in a range of industries and in a range of scenarios across the country. It's a crime that is underreported, and it's an intimate crime between people with very complex power relationships. And it's something that we definitely know is underreported, as are other crimes such as rape and even sexual assault.
You mentioned that it's an intimate kind of crime. So maybe that gives us insight into what kinds of examples of modern slavery there are. Like, how do they have that intimate element?
People often know the person. In the Australian context, they often know or have some sort of connection to the person that has enslaved them. And that's been our experience so far. And there's often a dependence on that person that helps to reinforce maybe the underlying vulnerabilities of the person who's the victim. Now, there are other cases where, you know, it isn't such a relational scenario. There's just recently been headlines around a case up in Brisbane involving what they call a slave house, where there was a phone scam. And it's alleged, I think, at this point, that people were in slavery to do some type of phone scam to extort money from wealthy Chinese people. Now, this is very recent. Who would think that this kind of scenario would happen, that you'd have people in slavery essentially in a call center?
So what kinds of industries are we talking about generally?
We're talking about so many different places and situations where slavery and slavery-like conditions can take place. I mean, you mentioned forced marriage as well. We've seen a number of increase in reports of forced marriage since forced marriage became a crime in 2013. We also see situations of something that we call slave-like marriage, where migrant women come here under the promise of having a loving relationship with a partner. They come here to study, to work, to build a family with that person. But upon arrival, it's clear that they were actually brought here just to be exploited and used as a slave. And that could be in a family business. That could be taking care of elderly parents. So we've seen a range of these situations that often present as family violence, but it's this family violence plus extreme exploitation.
How about we listen to one woman's experience? Her name is Sandra.
I was offered a job as a housekeeper by a family I worked for in the Pacific Islands. They promised me paid work and permanent residency in Australia. They organized and paid for me to come to Sydney. My passport was taken when I arrived. I did all their housework, washing, ironing, gardening, took care of the dogs and the swimming pool. I worked hard every day. They would threaten me, swear at me. I was not allowed out of the house and could not contact my family. They had control over my whole life. After 3 years without pay, there was no sign of my permanent residency, and I became fearful for my safety. One day I had the chance to ask someone for help. I don't know how but maybe there's someone called the Department of Immigration.
Now, Jenny, is Sandra's story typical of the modern slaves that come into contact with Salvation Army services? Like, is that whole idea of domestic servitude overly represented?
In my view, Sandra's story is fairly typical, and it's really sad to think that she was in that situation for 3 years before somebody saw that situation and did something about it.
So what is it that the Freedom Partnership can do for these women and men?
So what we really want to do is make sure that our communities are alert and aware to the signs of slavery and that we're active when we see things that concern us. Because, again, we're talking about often a prison without walls that people are behind. You know, there are some cases where people may actually be locked in a place, but most of the time the coercion that people are living under is psychological.
Tell us about the safe house. What happens at the safe house?
So the safe house is, you know, essentially a refuge where people can get help with figuring out a plan for their housing over the short term and the long term, medical assistance, mental health assistance, obviously food, clothing, kind of the basic welfare setup, and then ultimately education about all of their human rights, whether that's with regards to work or, you know, tenancy or in the realm of criminal justice, being a victim of crime. It's a comprehensive service, and it's unique. It's not funded by government. We rely on the community to provide that support to us, and we're lucky to have been able to run it for 8 years now.
So what can just ordinary people in the community do to help this kind of work?
I think it's really about being alert to who's in your community and what does their situation look like to you, and not feeling afraid to be friendly and caring and find out if people are in a safe situation. We had a scenario where a woman went to go have her massage that she usually has the day after she had seen a presentation in her church about human trafficking. And there was some concerning information shared by the masseuse, and we ended up getting 3 women out of that massage parlor who were in a slavery-like situation. We also encourage people, if they have information about someone whose life and safety is in imminent danger, to contact the authorities straight away. So your local OOO, but also the Australian Federal Police, because they have a specialist unit that investigates human trafficking, slavery, and slavery-like conditions across the country.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for telling us about the work of the Freedom Partnership.
Thank you.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. That was Jenny from the Freedom Project run by the Salvation Army. The Salvos, of course, are driven by Christian convictions, which is why they're involved in these kinds of initiatives. But doesn't the Bible have a mixed record when it comes to slavery? We're joined by John Dixon, historian and co-founder of CPX, who will shed some light on the issue. Welcome to the program, John.
Nice to be here.
Now, people often say that the Bible condones slavery, and in support of that, they can point to various passages that tell slaves to obey their masters. What do you do with those kinds of passages? You know, do the critics have a point?
They do have a point. The Old Testament does regulate certain kinds of bonded servitude that probably was not like what we think of as the terrible slave trade of the 7th, 8th, 18th centuries, but was more like the bonded servitude you might get in sort of 19th century England, somewhere between the two anyway. In the New Testament, it is pretty oppressive slavery. It's the Roman kind of slavery. And it was a very heavily regulated legal class of people that were slaves. And manumission, the freeing of slaves, was not an easy thing. And the economy depended on it a lot. And slaves were controlled because of the possibility of slave uprising. And so there was kind of a lot of brutality against slaves. Now, having said that, there are plenty of counterexamples, even in Roman society, where slaves of some aristocratic households were treated as kind of ambassadors on behalf of the household. And so a slave might be a highly educated person who's training the son of an aristocrat in arithmetic and grammar and poetry, and so is actually seen as like a bonded servant who was the professor of the house. To be a slave of the emperor himself was a very high and lofty position.
Almost an honour.
I'm sure that they would have chosen not to be a slave, but to still have the same gig. But if they had had to choose between being a freed person without the role of being the emperor's messenger or whatever, they would have chosen the slavery in the emperor. Now, the New Testament is written in this context where the Christians had absolutely zero power. And they had to work out, given that there were a number of converts in their midst who were slaves, and some converts who were slave owners or masters, how does one live as a Christian when you have no power to change the system, but you're not happy with the system? And the way the apostles did it, especially the apostle Paul, was to urge Christians to put up with a system they couldn't change, but to so regulate how slave and master interacted that it was as good as overturning it from within, so that slaves are told to obey their masters, just as Christians are told to obey the emperor. That's not an endorsement of imperial hereditary dictatorship, just because Christians were told to obey the emperor. It's really just saying, make the best of the situation. Be godly within a situation you can't change. But what Paul did say to masters is that you are no better than your slave, that you are brothers in Christ, and that you have a master above you, and so your treatment of your slave should be as a brother. And that is radical enough. There are a couple of examples in the New Testament where it's clear that the apostle would prefer people to be free. So in 1 Corinthians 7 and in a little book called Philemon, Paul advocates the release of slaves if possible, and he as good as asks Philemon to let his slave, who was a runaway slave and has come back, Onesimus, as good as asks him to release him and to treat him as a full freed person. So you get these little hints. That's in the New Testament. But there's a trajectory that the New Testament inspires so that in later periods you get even more radical attempts to subvert it from within.
So without outright calling for revolution, the New Testament is actually pretty subversive of the system in this respect.
It is, because it's asking masters to see their slaves as equals. In the Roman world, that was unthinkable. Slaves couldn't be equals by definition. That's where nature had placed them, in a place of absolute servitude. But the Christians tried to find ways to make sure equality ruled the day. So that by the second century, we have this one little document called the Shepherd of Hermas, where it seems that what's being urged upon the wealthy in the second century is to buy up mistreated slaves, slaves that they hear down the street who are being abused by their non-Christian masters, to see if you can purchase them into your own household, which was perfectly easy and permissible. So there, it's a real weird subversion. They still had no power in the second century, but it seems like what they thought was, if I can afford to buy five more slaves, I might as well buy the ones that I've heard are being abused by their masters so I can treat them as family.
So if you can just encapsulate for us, why is slavery such an affront to the Christian understanding of the person?
Because when a human being is seen as property, sellable, punishable because of an offence to me, killable because they tried to run away from this state of slavery, you're not treating them as made in the image of God. And this idea that every human being, regardless of capacity or utility, is valued by God because they're made in his image, changes the way one has to view slavery. Now, this is not to say Christians always got it right. They certainly didn't. And the wonderful signs of progress in the first, second, and third, and fourth centuries slowed down and even went backwards in the late Middle Ages, where slavery came back into Europe in a massive way, and the economy really depended on slaves and a new sort of batch of slaves from Africa. And so the whole thing was reborn, and it was reborn in a kind of Roman style. This kind of slavery was pretty much universal throughout world history. And the only real examples we have of serious subversion of this, attempts to subvert it, are from Christianity.
So it's that Christian vision of the person as being in the image of God and having a worth and a value that means that they can't be treated like a commodity. That's the kind of story that powers Christian efforts to eradicate slavery. If you want to find out more about the Freedom Project, then check out endslavery.salvos.org.au. You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. For more on Christianity and modern life, go to publicchristianity.org.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.